to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of British Columbia, located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. My name is Josh. You are listening to Textbook. This is a show about student life, textbook, and not-so-textbook approaches. Today is the water episode. We have three segments for you. The first one is an interview with the UBC Aqua Society, that is the scuba divers on campus. The second segment is a story by Paulina that I did some production help with. And the third segment is Ivana Besanowski for Tell Me About Your Paper, sending us off with a track from Swim Team. It's a jam-packed show today. Water is the theme. First, Bermuda Waterfall by Sean Nicholas Savage opening up the theme for us. It's a little cheesy today. Enjoy it. Here's the song.
In the pink and green of a ritual dream, I glide through your bathhouse, one hand to your ship deck. In the orient of space, where you wait with your twin, breathe silently for your season to come. Lost in the Bermuda trails, victim of
Do you want to know more about human rights abuses, global issues, and international politics? Are you interested in writing to foreign and local governments in response to global crises? Are you ready to give peace a chance? If your answer is yes, then Amnesty International UBC may be the club for you. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/AIUBC or send us an email at amnestyubc@gmail.com.
This is Josh Ciotero, 101.9 FM. The show is Textbook. I'm here in studio today with Viviana Lee and Marie Donahue. Tell me a little bit about your club and what you do.
So, hi, I'm Viviana. I'm actually a scuba instructor. So, I teach scuba diving at UBC Aqua Society.
I'm Marie. I am on the executive committee, and I just like to go out for the club dives, and I like to take part in scuba diving around Vancouver and surrounding areas.
So you guys are a scuba club, essentially. You're renting out equipment, you're doing trips.
We run also the PADI professional program, so we certify divers, not only the open water, but we also do advanced open water, rescue diver, or even dive master and instructor. So those are considered as professional divers.
I think the first question that a lot of people are going to have is, how do you do that on campus? Where do you have a space to do diving, or?
Okay, so there is no space to do it, but we do some trainings in the pool, and we go out in the open water to do our actual dives. And usually we go up to White Cliff Park, which is by Horseshoe Bay, and also Porto Cove. So those are the two popular sites to do any training dives.
What is the water like up there? What is it like?
It's pretty cold, actually. It gets pretty warm in the summer, but usually in the winter we like to do dry suit dives. So that's an extra specialty training that you can do. And I like to refer to it as like a James Bond, where you're completely dry within the suit, and when you come out you can rip off the suit and you can walk in a tuxedo.
And what's it like underwater? Is there coral? Is there fish? What was it like?
So we don't see a lot of corals here, but we do see some sponges. The water is actually emerald in color, so we call it the Emerald Sea. You actually see a lot of invertebrates, so like crabs, shrimps, sea anemone. Those are like the upside-down jellyfish. In the summer, you can actually see a lot of jellyfish. Yeah, not now, though.
Marie, tell me a little bit about your experience with swimming growing up and how you got into diving.
I've been very interested in swimming since I was like 2 months old when my dad threw me into a pool. Since then, I've become a lifeguard and a swim instructor. Recently, within the year, I decided to try out some scuba diving. And since the first time I was in the ocean, I just fell in love. It's been one of the most amazing experiences, and it's just been so much fun to try, and one of those bucket list things that you really get to check off.
And you, Viviana?
So I got into diving because of my research. So I researched the lionfish in Cuba. That's why I got into scuba diving. And after diving almost every day for 6 weeks, I just got hooked, and I have to keep going.
How long are you underwater usually when you go for a dive?
It depends, actually. Everybody is different. It depends on how good you are on air. For me, I can stay down there for 45 minutes to an hour just using a regular tank of air.
I can usually stay under for about the same time, but it also depends on depth. As the deeper you go, the more air you're going to consume. So if you're going to go like a lot deeper, like 60 to 100 feet kind of thing, you're going to run out of air a lot quicker. But if you stay around like the 20 to 30 feet range, you can usually stay down for a pretty long time and get a lot of travel distance in.
Viviana, I want to talk a little bit about your research. What is it? How does your research work? And are you observing fish when you go down, especially in Cuba? Were you going down to observe behavior, or were you collecting samples? What was it?
Yeah, so my research is actually a behavior research. So I I would go underwater with a team of divers, and I would observe how the behavior of lionfish. Essentially, I'm approaching the lionfish and see when they show any alert responses, and I mark that distance, and at the end, I just measure that distance and see if there's a good difference between a culled and non-culled site. Because if you don't know, lionfish are invasive in the Western Atlantic and the Caribbean, so we want to see if human culling has any effect on their behavior.
Very cool. What's the most striking thing that you've seen underwater? What's kind of one of your most vivid memories?
I have two that are probably the most amazing. The first one was one of my first dives I did without an instructor with me, and that was when I was diving in Comox, just on Vancouver Island. We were diving with sea lions, and they were probably the coolest thing to see underwater because they're basically like little puppies that are swimming around you. We were also told not to wear snorkels because they like to grab onto them and pull off your mask, and that can get a little fun. So the other thing that I got to see was when I went traveling to New Zealand, and I got to see an entire ship sunk underwater. It was a warship, and the clarity was about 60 feet, so we could see the entire ship like very clearly. It was absolutely phenomenal to see.
Believe it or not, that's like one of the hardest questions for me. I agree with Marie. I've dove with sea lions before, and they're absolutely amazing. I love them. But I would say if I have to pick, my absolute favorite will be the giant Pacific octopus. They are native to the Pacific water here. It's kind of hard to find them because they're not very abundant. But if you're lucky, then you can find them hiding in their den. So one of the amazing thing about that is that they can fit into any size of den or hole as long as their beak can get into it. So imagine like a 2 meter or 3 meters like tall octopus, they can actually fit into like a tiny, tiny hole.
What are the dangers like of scuba diving? What are kind of some of the things that you guys have to contend with?
I think one of the biggest things that we have to contend with is making sure that we are trained properly. You don't want to go down or too deep with not enough experience, because what it's going to do is it's going to make you nervous, and you might make mistakes when you're underwater and you're not trained properly. So one of the biggest causes of accidents underwater is not anything in the environment, but it's human error. So I guess that's one of the things that the UBC Aqua Society is really focused on, is we want to train all of our divers to be super comfortable with their own limits and their own boundaries and knowing everything that they could possibly know in the range that they're going to be comfortable with.
What does the UBC Aqua Society have coming up for the next year?
I can tell you what's going to coming up in about a few weeks. So we actually have a weekend trip down to Victoria and Race Rock. So that's our annual sea lion dive. We're going to do a few dives at Octum Point in Victoria. And then the next day, we're going to go on a charter and go out to Race Rock to dive with the sea lions. And throughout the years, we're going to have a few more trips and also local dives. We have local dives every month. Just keep an eye out for any updates.
Viviana and Marie, thank you so much for being with me today. I really appreciate you guys taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are you interested in Indian classical music? Sargam UBC develops a music community by organizing workshops, jam sessions, performances, and other fun activities like movie nights. We performed at various events from 2014 that comprised both Hindustani and Carnatic music. We began to host Ragini in March 2016, where we performed for 300 people, and the concert will be annual. Sargam is a club that is open to anyone who is interested in just listening or performing, and no experience is required. Sargam UBC is also interested in collaborating to make music with other clubs. Subscribe to our YouTube page and check us out on Facebook.
Hey, this is Josh. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Up next is a story by Paulina, produced by me, a story about water, a story about anxiety. I hope you enjoy it.
Hi, my name is Paulina, and this is a story about an experience in water. This happened when I was about 9 years old. I was somewhere in between grade 4 and 5. I grew up swimming competitively, and I was in 2 swim clubs. I would swim about 7-8 hours a week, which was a lot at the time. Back then, the only thing I did was either swim or go to school, and then when I wasn't swimming or at school, I would go home and I would start gaming. I would play Diablo 2 on the PC. I was like a level 90 plus sorceress, and so here I was at this age where I had really long and thin hair. I had glasses like in Harry Potter, so I had these round spectacles and these really not so great and flattering bangs. Furthermore, I was in the stage of my punk emo days where I basically watch a ton of Panic at the Disco music videos. I listen to a lot of My Chemical Romance. So here I was swimming, and swimming was really fun for me. I was able to just get into the water, and it was still considered a sport, but I didn't have to really interact with anybody else. It was really nice. I could just be in the water and be myself and think about all the other things that were going on, just be at one with the water. So it never felt like an enemy to me. It was always sort of like a friend. But of course, with competitive swimming, there's obviously the knowledge that a competition will come up soon. So I didn't really know when that was gonna be, but I did find out, you know, the time came when there was going to be the first swimming competition. And I don't know why everybody else seemed to know except for me. And to this day, I still don't know how I didn't know about the swimming competition until the moment when my swimming coach told me that we had one tomorrow. Like I wasn't prepared for this. I didn't even really know what a competition meant at the time. I just knew that I was somehow swimming competitively, but everyone else knew about it. So it was really weird. I didn't know what to expect at all. I think my mom drove me to UBC, which is where the swimming competition was held, in the Aquatic Center. And at the time when I got there, I was just in pure shock because it was such a huge building. You know that feeling when you're younger and everything just seems really, really big. It was massive. There were so many people in there. It was really hectic. And there were all these different kids in different groups, and all their parents were around in the stands as well, and the stands felt like they went on forever and ever. The swimming pool felt like this huge extension, and you almost couldn't even see the end of it if you were standing at one side. Yeah, there we were. Everyone was waiting around, and it was noisy in there, and I was trying to kind of calm myself down because I didn't know what to expect at all. And finally, I put on my swim cap, I put on my goggles, and here was Pinner Paulina, this tiny little lanky girl about to take on her first swimming competition. I got into the water because that's what the swim coach told me to do. And then all of a sudden, this gunshot goes off. And at this point, I'd never even heard a gunshot before. So I was kind of really, really freaked out and didn't even know what that meant, and forgot how to swim or that I was even meant to swim at that time. And I got, you know, super, super anxious. I just kind of froze up. I actually forgot to swim and I started to drown instead, which is not the best thing to happen to someone when they're, you know, in a swimming competition. I started drowning. I started choking on water, and it was just a very sad moment. And nobody was helping me because I think they thought that for some reason I'd be able to figure it out on my own and that I'd been doing so much swimming that I'd be just fine. But it took a while, and I just, you know, instead of feeling at one with water, I felt like this rock that was just sinking, and it was not a fun experience. The worst part is that after, when I gained my, you know, calmness to me and was feeling somewhat better than I had been before because I finally learned to use my body again in the water, everybody else had already gone there and back. And so they actually waited for me as I had to finish, you know, the competition. So I had to swim there and back, and I was doing the breaststroke. And every time I would have to come up for water, I would hear on one side of my ear just complete silence. So the entire aquatic center had just gone quiet all of a sudden. All the parents, all the kids, all the judges, all the coaches, I heard nothing. It was the worst. Like, I wanted to keep my head underwater. I did not even want to swim anymore. I just didn't want to hear anything because the silence just felt like it went on forever. And this pool felt like it had to go on forever and ever. And plus, I had to go there and back. So it just felt like two times infinity or something. So I got out, and all I remember is that I didn't end up going to any of the swimming lessons after that, or just like any of the swim club events or any practices. I just stopped going after that because it was just a traumatic experience. And I think it was some sort of foreshadowing into my later developed anxiety in my life currently. You know, that was like the very beginning of it is what I experienced during the swimming competition. Ever since then, I haven't really been in the water. It makes me feel really weird anytime I see a pool or something. It brings me back to all those times. And after that, I actually tried going swimming one more time after that. It made me feel dizzy, like physically dizzy, and I got motion sickness from just standing there in the pool. So it was some sort of kind of like a physiological effect that this experience had on me. And so ever since then, I have not gone swimming. I lived in the Philippines after that. A couple months later, I moved to the Philippines, and it was kind of my getaway from, you know, that entire routine of going swimming every day. Again, with this, it was like this unknown time in my life. I was going to go to this entirely new place that I didn't know anything about, and so again, also anxious about what any of this would look like when I finally arrived. That is my story about my experience in water and how it's had an effect on me, and I haven't been in the water since.
Bravo. Yes, indeed. This is going to make your world a lot different than the one I grew up in.
You know what?
CITR.
And?
Sure, it's over there.
And over there is where that sound is coming from. Right, Mr. Marconi?
Through the air, across the ocean. The first time ever.
Hey, we're back. Thank you to Polina for that story. This is Textbook on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. Up next, a song by Joanna Newsom. This is Kingfisher representing the birds of the sea on this water-themed episode today.
Whose is the hand that I will hold? Whose is the face I will see? Whose is the name that
the ground by something down there.
morning. There's blood on the eye. Unlace the glove, say honey, I am not sorry. Drifting ashes, and the naming rise above time as it flashing passes.
This is the recording artist Jay Arner, and you're listening to CITR.
Hey, we're back on Textbook CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia, situated on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. I'm here in the studio today with Ivana Besanovsky. Ivana, introduce yourself a little bit. Tell listeners what you're all about.
Hi, I'm doing well, thanks. I'm a fourth-year student here at UBC. I'm in the interdisciplinary program. My focus is actually philosophy, so generally I'm just studying humanities, and within that I focus on philosophy, but I'm also doing a lot of other credits within gender, race, sexuality, and social justice, creative writing, things like that.
That's great. What is the class you're going to be talking about for us today?
The class I'm going to be talking about is philosophy of sex and gender. And so basically we've been focusing a little bit on metaphysics, but also just bringing in some critical race theory, and lots of different things where we can sort of acknowledge how race does have an impact on social dynamics of sex and gender contemporarily.
How have you found this sort of course material in UBC, or how have you found it's been taught at UBC? Are you happy with the way it's been taught? Is this a, you know, are you happy with how this class has been unfolding?
Well, it's interesting because I'm in another course as well, which I thought would run sort of parallel to the content we're studying in this course. It's philosophy of power and oppression, and I find that a lot of the courses here tend to be more focused in analytical philosophy, which for me isn't as much as it's not as much of what I wanted to do, because I wanted to really delve into critical race theory and sort of deconstruct things like that. But the issue I have is that a lot of the topics we're talking about tend to get really abstracted and tend to shift their focus from some of sort of the really pertinent issues that I myself am inclined to do social work in. So when we're talking about things like oppression and intersectionality and sort of the material conditions of people's disenfranchisement, it tends to just become sort of really abstracted in political theory,
right?
In the sense that I feel that maybe we no longer really have access to the issues that, to me, are of the most critical importance.
Right, and that's a good segue for your paper too. Tell me a little bit about your paper.
My paper. So for this class, I decided to sort of tackle the issue of intersectionality and anti-racism, specifically within white feminism. Sort of that there's this push towards white feminist movements adopting an anti-racist praxis and subscribing to intersectionality within the movement and sort of identifying within that. But the case can tend to be that sort of subscriptions to intersectionality tend to be more superficial and lack more in-depth acknowledgement of the modes of oppression experienced by women of color. So it's sort of this subscription without fully internalizing or acknowledging. And as a part of that, sort of wanting to portray oneself, perhaps as a white feminist, as anti-racist, without properly understanding how to do that. And without properly understanding how to do that, you can't sort of deconstruct and you can't sort of reconcile those things and then be acting, you know, in a sense that's true to intersectionality, or really, you know, really understanding women of color's experience if you're just sort of saying, oh, yeah, I practice intersectional feminism, but not necessarily knowing what that might mean.
Right. And what white feminist groups are you thinking of, or who are you kind of defining as white feminists when you're thinking about this?
Well, it really depends. I guess you can look at a lot of content, even within academia, but I more specifically was even thinking about just contemporary feminist movements, even on the internet, even,
right?
You know, it's, I mean, I guess it's all a trend now with social media and things like this, but just sort of, the cachet of saying, oh, I'm an intersectional feminist without maybe knowing what that might entirely mean.
Right. When you're able to represent yourself online as having certain political views, but maybe not actually being able to stand up and you know, perform that in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think that's exactly it.
Who were you drawing on for this paper?
So I was drawing on two theorists. The first is Sarita Srivastava. She is actually a professor at Queen's University. And the essay she wrote is called "You're Calling Me a Racist: The Moral and Emotional Regulation of Anti-Racism and Feminism." And essentially, I think she actually did a lot of case studies within Canada, just going to different organizations where women were doing various kinds of work within communities. And she just found this trend of sort of what she calls the historical representation of the benevolent white middle-class helper who wants to subscribe to sort of this national self-image and sort of white feminist political project of being that benevolent figure who it's sort of like this innocent femininity or innocent feminism where women don't want to be called racist or don't want to acknowledge their racism in their praxis or in their beliefs, but which has to be a necessary part. So like if you have an organization where you say that you're relying on anti-racist praxis, but within that organization, the women within it aren't actually being self-critical and saying, where are the places where we are enacting racism, whether it's explicitly or sort of more unconsciously, then that can't actually be worked through at all. So that's where she kind of went in and did these case studies and sort of spoke with women who, a lot of them, she says, just broke down crying when they were sort of faced with the idea that they could perhaps be espousing anti-racist beliefs or even just acting in ways that would be exclusionary to women of color. And then she spoke to women of color about the same thing. And mm-hmm. I remember one of the most impactful quotes I remember reading was that one of the women of color that she interviewed just said, white women are always crying, women of color never cry. And I just found it so so insightful.
There's this kind of politics of empathy, right? That you can act really empathetic without, you know, and you can speak empathy and you can invoke empathy, but not really, putting that into practice, especially in organizing. I think that that's a real issue. I think, like you're saying, that you see that on Facebook, you see that on social media, you see that on whatever blogs and articles. So you're thinking about praxis and you're thinking about real organizing work, and do you have trouble balancing that kind of work and academic discourse? I mean, in your own life, do you find that a difficult kind of act to manage?
Well, I guess I do, in the sense that I already find, feminist theory within academia is so inaccessible and elitist already. But the line can be drawn to how it impacts sort of interactions. I mean, you can even see it on social media, right? Like recently, one of my friends posted an essay on Facebook, which was about pro-sex feminism, and you know, I didn't fully read the article. I didn't fully read the essay, to be honest, but I was kind of watching the comment war that ensued. And
that's often the best part.
Yeah,
really.
That's the best part. Yeah, so I'm looking at the comment section. And another woman I know who's a lovely woman, and she's a radical feminist, she comes in and she's just like, this is liberal feminism at its worst, like all these things, and throwing in a lot of sort of academic, sort of elitist jargon. Mm. So it's just this sort of thing of shaming women who might not have had access to the same sort of educational process as you might have. I find that to just be really oppressive, right? So it's sort of just... it just sucks.
Yeah, it does. And you were talking before also about how this paper kind of brings in a dimension of moral philosophy too. Can you talk a little bit about that angle of the paper?
Yeah, I think the emphasis on morality is just the fact that sort of women being compelled to want to subscribe to certain tenets within critical race theory and feminist theory. I think this sort of being compelled comes from a place of wanting to subscribe to certain moral projects. But it's a little unfortunate in the sense that actually intersectionality in its inception began from Black feminism with the Combahee River Collective, with sort of the Black feminist statement that they gave, and a lot of Kimberly Williams Crenshaw's work. So it's this case where actually Black women have been the women to sort of conceptualize and put forward this project of examining feminist politics from an intersectional lens. And now that project has, in a sense, been co-opted by white feminism, in the sense that a lot of academia and a lot of discourse is portrayed to be, within intersectional conversation, is portrayed to be something that white women have sort of maybe not conceived, but have the biggest part in sort of setting forward within discourse. And that's just sort of not the case, especially when some of their usage of some of this terminology or some of the conceptualizations tends to be sort of more superficial and inattentive, because they really just might not understand some of the more you know, visceral material conditions of what it means to be disenfranchised and what it means to be oppressed in whatever social context that women of color do experience and only they can kind of speak to in a sense.
Ivana, thank you so much for talking today. You've been very articulate.
Thank you.
Do you have a song to send us off?
I do. There's actually a song off of Swim Team's new album called Santé that I've been listening to a lot.
Great. This is Swim Team's Santé here at CITR 101.9 FM. Up next at the top of the hour is Discorder Radio. Hey, we're back, CITR 101.9 FM. This is Textbook. We have a few minutes here closing up, so I figured I'd play a couple more songs. Up first is Julia Holter, The Sea Calls Me Home, and then we finish it off with a very, very jumbly underwater track, very low-quality track from Arthur Russell, one of my favorites. It is Let's Go Swimming. Here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from traditional, ancestral, and unceded Musqueam territory. Thank you very much for listening today. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are now tuned into the sounds of Disc Order.